The Guardian.
Are you an aspiring journalist or writer? The Guardian International Development Journalism Competition is your chance to win an assignment to Africa, Asia, or South America. You'll write for The Guardian about the global development issues that face the area you visit. All you need to do is submit a short essay on one of the 12 diverse themes. You can find all the information you need at guardian.co.uk/journalism competition. Enter now to win the work experience of a lifetime. Visit guardian.co.uk/journalism competition. The deadline is midnight on Sunday, the 12th of May. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Big Ben was silenced, thousands lined the streets, and hundreds turned their backs. Margaret Thatcher was laid to rest, but what of Thatcherism? Meanwhile, another three-term Prime Minister battles to shore up his own legacy. Tony Blair and his ministers offer guidance, rather publicly, to Ed Miliband. Is it a show of strength from the old Blairites or a last throw of the dice? And the bad economic news keeps on coming. Unemployment is up as Britain is criticised by the IMF for its over-hasty cutting. Joining me in the studio is The Guardian's Martin Kettle, our social affairs editor, Randeep Ramesh, and contributing editor to Conservative Home, Andrew Jimson. A warm welcome to you all. The laying to rest of Britain's first and only woman Prime Minister opened old wounds from the 1980s, but it also reminded her supporters that the Conservatives could win landslides at elections and left some pining for a Tory leader with a similar iron will. A Guardian poll even suggested that a young Maggie would see the Tories storm to victory at the next election. Martin, you were at St Paul's Cathedral yesterday. Was this a fitting funeral for someone who loomed large in British history, do you think?
I think it was a deeply inappropriate funeral. I think that it was an attempt to equate Margaret Thatcher with Winston Churchill, or possibly even, dare one say it, the Queen, both of which were comparisons which she occasionally toyed with in her lifetime, but both of which were inappropriate. And I think it was, as an event, really, it was an event which the Tory party was going to have to face one day, and actually I think it probably went off quite well, but I think it was deeply inappropriate.
Andrew, what do you think? I mean, I think you're a Conservative who I've heard describe himself as drippingly wet.
The only time I supported Margaret Thatcher very, very strongly was when a lot of third-rate Tory MPs were trying to save their own skins by throwing her overboard. At that point, I suddenly felt a spasm of loyalty. But of course, she's always been a highly indigestible figure for the right as well as for the left. I think she was a genuine Tory, but her personality was so bizarrely different to that of most British politicians, primarily not because of ideology, but because she wasn't a defeatist. She actually had the immensely unfashionable idea that various battles could be fought and won, and some of them she did go on to win. I was worried that the funeral was going to be overdone. I thought it went off surprisingly well. I thought the music was absolutely sublime.
But the, the thing you've highlighted there, which I've seen a number of people who admired her write in the last week, is, you know, she was a fighter, she was a battler, almost more than anything else. But how does that fit with, you know, something like a state funeral that's meant to unify?
Well, the Church of England exists to assimilate people, I suppose, into the establishment. I'm not sure she would have been entirely happy being taken quite so completely to the establishment's bosom as she was
that's
yesterday.
An interesting point. Randeep, and we also had the Bishop of London, Richard Charters, give a twist on the much chewed over, no such thing as society line. What do you think he was up to there?
I think in death, you know, I think Christians tend to celebrate the best things about people, and I thought he sought to explain, rather admonish her. I mean, there was plenty of Christian theology that would allow him to do so, but he chose the sort of open route of saying, this is what she believed in, let me tell you what that, where the roots of that lay. For most people of my leaning, I suspect, it was the wrong interpretation of what society is. And she had little time for economic justice and social justice. I mean, her view was that people created their own luck, that that you didn't need to change capitalism. People needed to change, and their behaviours and their actions were responsible for their downfall. And I think that's really lay at the heart of conservative thinking for a long time. So I don't think she was a radical in that respect, but I think in economic terms, her disposal of economic justice as a theme of conservatism was fairly radical stuff, and I think we live with that legacy today.
So, I mean, still people reinterpreting different bits of what Margaret Thatcher said in different ways, Martin. I suppose that does mean it's not a Diana moment, although I'm not sure whether that's for better or for worse.
I think there was a case for saying that the funeral was an attempt to elevate Margaret Thatcher and Thatcherism into some place above politics and above dispute. And in a sense, on the day after the funeral, I just think, well, fine, by all means try, but it's not going to happen. And Margaret Thatcher's death was at the centre of the ceremony in St Paul's yesterday, not her life, really. And I think these things are, you know, they are now in the past. And I actually think Thatcherism, as I understand it, is in the past. And I think that we should be careful not to be too apocalyptic about the effects of the death of Mrs. Thatcher or the lasting significance of what happened yesterday. I mean, on the level of how should Britain bid farewell to prime ministers, I think there could be some useful low-key lessons to be learned to provide some kind of public funeral for prime ministers, but treating prime ministers as though they were heads of state, and in particular as military leaders, is just inappropriate in the 21st century. And, you know, it's not... it's just a false trail.
Really. I think Marlin's absolutely right. I mean, what we've confused is the Americanization of our politics. It's a Mount Rushmore effect. So you go into Westminster and you see the creators of 20th century Britain.
Well, hang on. Disraeli, can't remember what sort of funeral he had, but we had the Primrose League, a colossal mass movement in his memory. I wonder whether there'll be a cult in memory of Thatcher. I haven't yet managed to establish what her favourite flower was.
I think
Disraeli's probably wasn't the Primrose.
Andrew, actually, all I refer to is the you know, joining together Clem Attlee, Lloyd George, Winston Churchill and Margaret Thatcher as the 20th century's leaders of Britain. Now, the difference is with the head of state argument in the United States, where you carve the kind of founding fathers into the stones of the rock, they were the head of state. They were the president. They were the equivalent of kings.
I think that's
the difference.
I just
with
love
our
coming
system.
To The Guardian. The last sticklers for correct form.
I think it should be said that Andrew is the only person around the table who's not wearing a tie.
Oh, yes, that's true.
a decisive put down there, Andrew. Let's just turn to the,
outed as a Cameroon, a disaster, yes.
Let's just turn to the sort of political fallout, if there is any. I mean, the people from YouGov who do the most regular polls, so it's sort of probably not been any real effect. They were saying to me yesterday, in terms of like voting intention, I thought there would be a big boost because it has been, you know, people are nostalgic and you've just had lots and lots of clips of the 1980s that when it looked like the government knew what it was doing, if nothing else.
I think it might make it even more difficult for Cameron to control his own party because, of course, a lot of the present, in many individual cases, gifted intake of Tory MPs, the ones who came in 2010, they do revere Thatcher and they hanker for that kind of leadership. It's completely unrealistic hankering. She was, Cameron couldn't possibly be like that, and nor could anyone else who one can see in the Tory party. And there is a big danger for them if they take the message that what you need to do is treat the electorate as rugged individualists. Well, all the polling shows that people don't feel like rugged individualists, or very few do. Most of them feel that their lives are extremely precarious and that they need sort of help and reassurance, and they need to feel that the government is on their side, which they don't generally feel about Cameron and Osborne.
Do you think, I mean, what's your own view on how Cameron reads it? It's felt at moments in the last few weeks, particularly he was sort of came up with this line, we're all Thatcherites now, as if he's he maybe is having a bit of a rethink and maybe thinking he does need to listen to the body of the Conservative Party saying he needs to sort of exert a bit more of a smack of firm government.
Well, he needs to keep them on side, and he will use issues like Europe, as he has already to some extent. I mean, there will be the occasional no. It won't be quite done with quite the passion, or anything like the passion that Thatcher did it, but he'll play that card at some point.
And Martin, do you think Cameron is liable to being scared off what was, you know, a clear strategy before of disowning a lot of the Thatcher legacy, in fact? Or do you think he still knows his own mind?
Well, I do wonder whether he quite knows his own mind, because I think he, over the last 6 months or so, his strategy has been marked mainly by fear of his party and the difficulty of managing his party. And that's been true at a number of levels, most particularly, obviously, on Europe. But we've seen it again in the last 10 days with regard to Mrs. Thatcher. I mean, I think, we're not all Thatcherites now. But what we are all now is capitalists. And I think that's the difference. And I think that the two things are... It's just a category error to confuse the two. I mean, the reason you can't have another Margaret Thatcher in the foreseeable future is not because of lack of character and press-on spirit and general sort of spine in our politicians. Nothing whatever to do with that. Thatcher was Thatcher because, ultimately, of the Falklands War, as we saw yesterday at the funeral. Everything else followed from that.
Well, hang on. There things like the union reforms and the...
Yeah, they were very controversial.
Highly controversial and done cautiously and step by step, yes.
Until they weren't. And I mean, we tend to define Thatcherism in retrospect now.
Yes.
Seen through the wrong end of the telescope, seen through the kind of, frankly, rather delusional imperial empress Thatcher of the late 80s.
Yes.
And of course, the unforgettable, to those of us who were there, weeks of her political demise and downfall. But I think the real question... facing all parties in British politics is the management of capitalism. When Thatcher was Prime Minister, there was still, on one level, on a global scale, a socialist alternative. There was, however corrupt and vicious it was, Chinese and Russian socialism. Today there's North Korea. We have all embraced the reality of living under capitalism. Now, what that means and what that should mean and how you manage it are huge and divisive questions in their own right. But that, I think, is where we are now. We're not all wrapped in the flag, in love with the British military and revering Mrs. Thatcher as somehow symbolising the nation that we are today.
It's interesting, this point about politicians being defined by their enemies. I saw Fraser Nelson said a good line yesterday about Mrs. Thatcher. You know, she was a fighter. She kept fighting. And in the end, she was like a drunk in a pub asking, where's the next person to knock out when all the union leaders, the Soviet Union, everyone else had gone? And that's why she had to go.
And she was left with Geoffrey Howe.
She was left with Geoffrey Howe to have a fight with. Let's turn to someone else. I don't know whether we regard him as a fighter or not, Randeep. But he was in St. Paul's paying his respects yesterday. And after a period of silence, Tony Blair has returned to Labour Party politics, on paper at least. A recent essay for the New Statesman was followed up by TV appearances by members of his old fan club and colleagues of his who were all offering advice to Ed Miliband. And there was a line in there, along with some very specific policy points, Randeep, about how DNA databases and things might be the answer for Labour, and then some more general points about showing responsibility on public spending. There was also a couple of lines that looked like they might have been designed to wound Ed Miliband, saying what people need above all at this time is leadership. What do you think he's doing? Do you think he's trying to rescue his own reputation, or is he trying to help his successor?
I think the problem is that for previous inhabitants of the leader's role, there are only two modes, isn't there? Aren't there? The silent and unhelpful. Anything you say becomes interpreted. I suspect behind this there was more thought in the intervention. It certainly read like it. He definitely has some ideas that perhaps he could have quietly slid into John Cruddas's pigeonhole as part of sort of mulling over in the policy review, but he chose to do it in the press. I suspect Ed Miliband is balancing factions in the Labour Party, and the Blairite faction sees a chance to recall some of the glories and push harder for its place in the sun.
And when you say it sees a chance, what makes you think there's a chance right now?
Well, I think Ed Miliband has survived. He survived both a Ballsite kind of rebellion when there was wobbles, and he survived to impose some sort of discipline on the party. But the Blairites, I think, do feel that there are policy prescriptions that, if they're allowed to drift, will simply never be taken up by the leadership. And this, I think, is a part of that. I think it's rather, we see it as coordinated. I don't think it is. I just
but
think
when
it's
you
people.
You see John Reed and Tessa Jowell and people come out and do interviews for the first time in a while in response to Tony. I mean, what do you think, Martin? Do you think it's coordinated?
I don't think it's coordinated, no. I think it's it's what happens when everybody focuses on something like the Blair intervention. Then people ring up Blair and he says he's not going to appear on the radio.
So you ring
they
John
ring
Reed.
Up John Reed and he says, well, yeah, I suppose so. And I think that's what happens. I don't think it's coordinated in that respect. I think rather the same thing about Blairism as I think about Thatcherism. I mean, I think it's a mistake to think that to use these categories. I think that the Labour Party still has to face the question of how it intends to manage capitalism, as I was saying before, mm-hmm. but also how it deals with the reform of the public services. And that remains the question that Labour is reluctant to answer. Now, you know, the strategy that is being followed at the moment does have some signs that it's coming to a head now. I mean, the Cruddas process is going to produce a report in the autumn. And, you know, so, you know, we've all, in one sense, just got to wait for, you know, the clock to tick to round to the right time. But I think, you know, what Blair said, I think it undoubtedly he meant to say it. I suspect he did not intend to have it to have quite such an explosive has it had an explosive effect? I mean, to have created such a lot of interest as it has, and I think journalists do tend to you know get into a feeding frenzy.
But he's good with words, Tony, isn't he? I mean, and for him to say what people want at this time above all else is leadership. Do you not think he would have been someone who'd know what he was doing in using a phrase?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I think, I think it's there's no doubt that he is frustrated that David Miliband didn't win the Labour leadership. I think he thinks that David Miliband was the only person of the available candidates in 2010 who would face Labour with the questions which it needs to answer in order to not just to win an election, but to win an election in such a way that it can stay in power when taking the difficult decisions that will face any government. And I think I also think he's pretty isolated from British politics at the moment. I think the weakness of his position is not that what he says is wrong. I think a lot of it is right, but his political weakness is his lack of a political base, because he jets into the country and out of the country. I mean, I actually went to see Blair on Monday, as it happens, but on Monday evening he flew to Washington,
right.
and on Tuesday night from Washington he flew back for the Thatcher funeral on Wednesday. I'm not sure where he is today, but I wouldn't be surprised if he was in the Middle East.
How was he on Monday?
Well,
it
was a private conversation, as you know the rules about
not
these
private
things.
Anymore.
but my point is to illustrate that he is basically in and out the whole time, and I don't think he has quite such the legendary feel that he once did for, you know, Middle Britain. And I think Ed Miliband has got some things to teach him. I can exclusively reveal that he is going to meet Ed Miliband in the next few days. And so to that extent, I think some of the apparent confrontation between the two
may be
about to be resolved.
Do you think he liked Ed Miliband? He obviously wasn't his chosen candidate, but do you think he sort of...
Don't know.
Miliband isn't... we don't really know yet about Miliband, do we? And that doesn't necessarily
matter. We did a poll this week, which
perhaps we do know.
Dreadful.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Fred Miliband.
Well, we know he's jolly unpopular.
It slightly got overshadowed by obviously Thatcher stuff and all focus on the Tories. And it made me wonder if it was one of those cases of the only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
There was
on minus 23.
There was a poll that Lord Ashcroft did before Christmas, actually, which I think suggested that Labour would be over 50% if it had another leader than Ed Miliband, though that rather begs the question of who the other leader might be. Yes, but on the other hand, Rome wasn't built in a day. He can't... I mean, it would be ridiculous of him to start giving very specific questions, answers to very difficult questions too quickly. I think I respect him for taking his time over it. On the other hand, and I also, to some extent, respect him for not... I mean, Blair's game was sort of transparently to attack the Labour Party and annoy the Labour Party enormously. and Middle England was then expected to think, well, Blair must be okay because all these leftists are jumping up and down and are very wounded by his latest decisions.
So it was the same old trick.
On the other hand, you have to, in the end, I'm afraid it's a terribly dreary but appallingly important question, what to do about the deficit. And in the end, you do need something robust to say about that.
Well, let's turn to economics and the deficit now, in fact, because all the parties need to face it. And it's been another bad week for people who support the orthodox austerity. Not only is unemployment inched up, unemployment's been one of the few bright spots up until now. We've seen that wages are stuck. Cost of living is going up 3%, but wages are only going up by 0.8%, meaning that people are currently getting poorer at roughly the same sort of rate that in ordinary years they'd expect to get richer. And that's 5 years after the slump. On top of that, we've had the chief economist of the IMF, who the people who normally use diplomatic language, saying that George Osborne's playing with fire. And we've had at Harvard a couple of the most influential economists in the pro-austerity debate have to come clean about a spreadsheet error, which exaggerates, apparently, so it says in today's Financial Times, the effect of public debt on growth. So a bad week for austerity.
Well, I don't think we've had orthodox austerity. That was announced after they'd won in 2010, and they had that press conference of the Treasury during David Laws's first brilliant ministerial career, and we thought there were going to be savage cuts, and there weren't. And we're borrowing a most, I wouldn't be able to, if I looked at a spreadsheet, I wouldn't be able to tell if there was an error in it or not. We are borrowing astronomical sums of money. And I think Osborne is slightly imprisoned. I mean, I suppose he's done it politically, hasn't he? He's borrowing just about as much as we possibly can. So it's very difficult for Labour to outbid that without looking even more irresponsible than he is.
So would you rather that he said, right, we want more?
Well, I think he might have. If he took economics more seriously, in fact, he only really thinks about politics as far as I can see, he would have done something more decisive in 2010 and have become, as you know, we're back to dear old Maggie, but they'd have become a hell of a sight more unpopular by now. But with some glimmer of getting the public finances sorted out, which they haven't.
But we're not talking about the TUC, we're talking about the IMF or whatever, saying we're cutting too quickly. I mean,
I honestly don't have an informed these gentlemen probably have an informed
think,
opinion
Randy?
About that. I don't.
Well, I mean, you know, the austerity debate, the Rogoff-Reinhardt mistake. The IMF in October warned that that he was sucking too much money out of the economy. This is an update, and I think it's surprising because the IMF is seen as the great troika of sort of the vanguard of sort of tooth and claw capitalism, and they're telling who should have been one of their star pupils, you may have got this wrong. And I think it's difficult to see. I think this is really about the argument between the roundheads like George Osborne, who basically wants to destroy New Labour's legacy, and the sort of Keynesian restorationists who want to spend money in order to preserve what we had. And this lies some sort of strange argument, some strange political argument between these two sides. I think the choices would have been not that different, actually, should the Labour Party have taken power. That's the worrying thing. It's the envelope would have remained the same. It's whether you could have produced growth in order to bring down the borrowing. And I don't think that the public really understands that, which is why Balls loses the political.
So you think
debate.
It's going to be just dismal whoever. You don't think Osborne's missed a trick. You think it was going to be.
I lean towards the Keynesian side. I mean, you know, that I think that if you'd spent a bit more, you would have been able to raise growth and therefore bring down borrowing. But I think that's a very difficult political sell. As we've seen, Balls has failed to do it. I think that the flip side of that is the kind of creative destruction argument isn't working. And that's the problem.
Martin, what do you think?
Well, I think that the reason that austerity isn't working is because it is being practiced on too wide a scale across Northern Europe. I don't think it's something that's unique to Britain. I think it's heavily compounded by the failure of the Eurozone and the dominance of austerity there. And I think that is the bind that we have all got ourselves into. I mean, what Osborne and Laws were saying in 2010 might have made a certain sense if Britain had been in a unique position of having sort of basically got overdrawn when everybody else was paying their bills. But that's not the case. Everybody was, for different reasons, but in essentially because of the financial collapses of 07 and 08, in the same boat. The great Keynesian nostrum is that, you know, if you save and everybody's spending, that's okay. But if everybody saves, it's a disaster. And perhaps exaggerating to say it's a disaster at the moment, but it's certainly extraordinarily difficult. And until there's some, and I think the IMF, especially under its current phase, and with the Americans playing the slightly more reflationary role in that argument now, that, you know, what's got to happen is some kind of loosening. And, you know, but that's very difficult politically for Osborne. And as Andrew says, you know, Osborne's strategy is a political strategy. And the problem for Osborne is that his political strategy could be unravelling unless Ed Miliband scores an own goal.
But Andrew, finally, I mean, I think Randeep explained well that, you know, Ed Balls hasn't been able to get this Keynesian thing across. And I'm not talking about whether it's right or not, just like this argument that you can, it can always be parodied as the argument that you can cure debt by getting more debt. That falls on the grounds it doesn't feel plausible. George Osborne, his policy seems to be like just not delivering growth, whatever his policy is. It's going to be a fairly dismal choice for voters at the next election, isn't it? A policy they don't believe, or one that's been shown to have failed.
I would be inclined to move Balls, although he's great fun. He's one of the few interesting members of the Shadow Cabinet. I'm a bring back Alistair Darling man myself. I think Osborne would find it very difficult against Darling.
Interesting thought. We'd better leave things there. So, because that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to Randeep, Martin and Andrew. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
Are you an aspiring journalist or writer? The Guardian International Development Journalism Competition is your chance to win an assignment to Africa, Asia or South America. You'll write for The Guardian about the global development issues that face the area you visit. All you need to do is submit a short essay on one of the 12 diverse themes. You can find all the information you need at guardian.co.uk/journalism competition. Enter now to win the work experience of a lifetime. Visit guardian.co.uk/journalism competition. The deadline is midnight on Sunday the 12th of May. Terms and conditions apply.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.